Good morning. I'd like to call the Senate Finance Committee to order. Please turn off all cell phones. Today's Tuesday, March 2nd, 2021. Today with us are Co-Chair Stedman. Senator Olson is online. Senator Wilikowski is here. Senator Wilson is on the way on other state business, but he's hustling up here. And Senator Hoffman and myself, Senator Bishop. Senator Von Imhoff could be joining us shortly online as well. So we have a full complement at the table and online. And Senator Wilson is here. Before I begin, I'd like to thank our support staff, Allison and Kelsey. Good morning, ladies. And we're going to take up Senate Bill 22 first. We had a little schedule change this morning, and so we're just flipping bills to keep moving and keep the schedule going. And then we will hear Senate Bill 19. And the hearing on the Executive Order 119 has been removed from today's schedule. Any other business to come before the committee before we start? Seeing none, Senate Bill 22, this is today's first hearing, and it's an act repealing the termination date for intensive management hunting licenses surcharge. So this will be the first hearing, and our intention is to hear and hold this bill today. And here to present, we have Senator Rivak online, and Emma Torkelson, if you could please bring yourself to the table, put yourself on the record, and please proceed with your introduction. And Senator Rivak, can you hear us?
Yes, good morning, Co-Chair Bishop and members of the Senate Finance Committee. I can get started here with a brief overview, if you like, and then hand it over to my aide, Ms. Torkelson.
Yes, okay. So, Senator Rivak, if you put yourself on the record, and please give your opening comments, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, this is Senator Rivak. I represent District M. Thank you so much for hearing SB 22, an act repealing the termination date for the intensive management hunting license surcharge. This bill came before this committee last year and passed out of the Senate. This is the same language. This was asked for by the sportsman community, and I think that means a lot when a group wants to pay their own way, which is what they're doing here. SB 22 is a revenue bill. It brings up funds. It brings in funds for the state. And how it does that is by leveraging Pittman-Robertson funds. Intensive management will continue under this bill to be directly sourced from the surcharge as opposed to general fund appropriations. This is a user-funded bill, and again, they've asked for it. So it's one of those things that helps our game population, and Emma will get more into that. But importantly, it'll be used again to leverage the Pittman-Robertson 75-25 match. So 1 million gets 3 million in match dollars. And so, as everybody knows, we're in a cash crunch, especially in the Department of Fish and Game. So this will help a bunch to continue the great efforts that they do. We've heard a lot of support for it. We feel like it's been working really well. And so with that, I'll pass it over to Ms. Torkelson to go into some of the details.
Okay, I'm just looking to see if any committee members had a question for you, Senator Rivak, but it doesn't appear so. So, Ms. Torkelson, if you'd put yourself on the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Good morning, Senator Bishop and members of the Senate Finance Committee. For the record, Emma Torkelson, staff to Senator Rivak. Thank you for the opportunity to present SB 22 today, an act repealing the termination date of the intensive management hunting license surcharge. Hunting is an essential part of many Alaskans' lives, but in order to maintain sustainable wildlife populations for future generations, careful management of those populations is necessary. That's where intensive management comes in. So, the moment a moose, caribou, or deer population becomes at risk of falling below a sustainable level, the intensive management program seeks to identify the root cause of the issue and then develops and implements a plan to rectify that issue. Most often these plans are focused on research and management, but they can also include habitat enhancement. And I know there was a question last year about from Senator Hoffman about how these intensive management programs have increased big game populations since they've been implemented. And there is a document included in your packet that specifically addresses and includes some numbers of how those populations have been increased in one particular case. Prior to 2016, this program was funded by general fund appropriations, as Senator Rivak pointed out. Since 2016, however, it's been funded by a surcharge placed on hunting licenses that are then used to match federal dollars. I will note here that true subsistence hunters and senior hunters are exempt from paying this surcharge. So when the surcharge was originally passed back in 2016, it included a sunset date to give an opportunity to review it. The bill before you now repeals that sunset date in an effort to continue this successful program into the future. Every year, the surcharge brings in approximately $1 million in user funds, and then they are leveraged for another $3 million from the Pittman-Robertson match grant from the federal government. So the passage of SB 22 ensures that intensive management can be self-sustainable and user-funded, so it can continue to protect our wildlife populations and promote food security across Alaska. Thank you once again for the opportunity to present this bill, and we would appreciate the committee's support.
Thank you. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Emma, you said elderly are exempt. What was the other category?
There's a hunting license through the chair, Senator Hoffman. Hunters who qualify for an income-based hunting license, which are it's a reduced price hunting license, they're exempt from paying the surcharge. So I believe their hunting license only costs $5. And that can be, we have the commissioner from Fish and Game here, Doug Vincent Lang, who can speak to more specific questions as well.
So the question that I have is that people in rural Alaska that are heavily dependent upon hunting to supplement their food source, which are primarily subsistence hunters, would, maybe this would be for Senator Rivak, would he object to including an exempt status of subsistence hunters that do not do this for sport, but do it for providing food on their table?
This is Senator Hoffman, through the chair. This is Senator Rivak. We would absolutely entertain looking at that. I think the intent of this bill is actually to increase populations in areas specifically where they do subsistence hunting. So that falls in line with the intent of the bill, and would definitely be open to looking at that.
Mr. Chairman,
if I might continue.
Senator Hoffman, continue.
The other question that I have, Senator Rivak, I've had the Fish and Game budget for a number of years and have had discussions with the commissioner, and he could verify that we have, there have been many instances, particularly in the fisheries component, where people have come up and contributed to the management of the resources as a supplement. But over time, the department has taken that and reduced the general fund obligations and used that donation to the state of Alaska and have supplemented and reduced the general fund portions. So my question to you is, the intent of this bill is not to supplant general funds, but to add to it so that we can continue the additional management of the resource. Is that the intent, Senator Rivak?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, Senator Rivak here. It is the intent of this bill. The user groups asked for it so that they can better manage the game populations for sustainable yields. And maybe I could, if I could, Mr. Chairman, maybe I could have the commissioner who's on address that as well.
Yeah, he'll be up here shortly, so.
I greatly appreciate your comments, because it's been a battle to continue to give the department the necessary finances so that we can continue to do what the Constitution says is that manage our resources to the maximum extent possible. And it seems in many cases the interest is to cut the budget rather than look at what the services we are required to do under state management. That has been a battle that I've had for a number of years now, and I'm glad to see that at least with this legislation it could be looked as turning around, and I wish the department had that same philosophy. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, this is Senator Olson.
Senator Olson, please continue. Ask your question.
Yeah, Ms. Bergelson, you listed the game that were included as deer, caribou, and moose. Are those the only animals that are covered under this bill?
Senator Olson, through the chair, I will defer to the commissioner on this question. I don't know that off the top of my head.
Senator Olson, the commissioner is going to be up next on a public invited testimony from the department.
Sure. My real question has to do with whether muskox were involved or included, but we'll save that for the commissioner.
Yeah, I see he's nodding his head. He's heard your question, so we'll expect an answer from him when he gets up here.
One other question, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
On the user groups that Senator Rivak talked about, are those including the big game guides, the big game hunters that come from out of state that are going to be exempted as well?
Emma, are you prepared to answer that, or Senator Rivak?
Senator Olson, through the chair, this is Senator Rivak. Anybody who buys a tag who wouldn't fall under the classes of folks, the elderly here in Alaska who receive discounted licenses. So yes, those out-of-state hunters who purchase licenses would be then contributing to this fund.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Good to hear from you. Did I see another question from the table? Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. At some point, I'd like to have information brought back to the committee on the geographical dispersion of the revenue generation here, so we can see where the sales of these licenses are as best as the department can get to us. I recognize that some of the issues are dealt online and they might have some problems there, but it'd be nice to get a better feel for geographical dispersion around the state. And while they're doing that, they might as well try to give us an idea on the non-resident licenses, where they're from. Might be handy for the Resources Committee for general information.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. A great question. And Emma, I see you taking notes, and I know Aaron has got it covered behind me as well. So, good question. I have a question. Senator Rivak, so would I be classified as elderly under this bill because I'm over 60 and I have a lifetime hunting license?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rivak, yes, you would be exempt from paying this fee under those conditions. Those are all separate. This doesn't change any of those other regulations. This imposes a user fee on regular hunting licenses in Alaska. So those would be exempt, correct?
All right, thank you. I just hadn't considered myself and come to realization yet, can get my head around being elderly, but thank you. I'm just trying to bring a little levity to the table this morning. All right. Any other questions for Senator Hoffman?
One other question, Senator Rivak. I know the state of Alaska has a graduated tax license for in-state versus out-state hunters. Would you consider a staggered surcharge for intensive game management for in-state versus out-of-state hunters?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, Senator Rivak, I think getting this is a sunset bill, and so it's eliminating the sunset. And so what I wouldn't like to do is complicate it to the point where we leave these Pittman-Robertson funds on the table. And so certainly open to amendments, but I think it's critical that we, especially during these fiscal times, not leave these matching funds on the table. So with that in mind, we're certainly open to suggestions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman, for the question. And Ms. Torkelson, did you want to make a comment?
Yeah, I just want to add to that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hoffman, or Senator Hoffman, through the chair. Currently in statute, the surcharge for residents is $10, and the surcharge for out-of-state residents is $30. So there already is a difference.
Not for intensive management?
No, not as far as I know. I can't speak to intensive management. For the surcharge, there is
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hoffman.
Having had this budget, fish and game budget, for over 20 years, I'm well aware of that fact.
Okay, no further questions, Commissioner. I believe we are ready for you to come up for invited testimony. Thank you, Emma.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Doug Vincent Lang, and I'm the Commissioner for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today about SB 22. The Alaska legislature recognized the importance of wild game meat to Alaskans as a food source, consistent with Article 8, Section 4 of the Alaska Constitution, and passed the Intensive Management Law in 1994. This law requires the department and the Board of Game to identify moose, caribou, and deer populations that are especially important food sources, and to ensure that the populations remain large enough to provide food security for Alaskans through an adequate sustained harvest. Recognizing the potential for federal interference in state IM programs, the department funded its IM programs under the IM law from a series of capital budgets. As the capital funds were expended and new funds were not allocated, hunters became concerned about the future of IM in Alaska. Because of the success of state-conducted IM programs and increasing ungulate, primarily caribou and moose, populations on state lands, hunters requested an intensive management surcharge to be added to the licenses. This was requested by hunters, not by the department. This request was made to ensure that funds were dedicated and available to assess and conduct intensive management activities, especially given the reluctance of federal managers to conduct intensive management on their lands using federal funds. The legislature agreed and added an intensive management surcharge to hunting licenses in 2016. And the surcharge has been collected since January 1st, 2017, has been used to fulfill our obligations under the state's IM law. Intensive management programs that enhance habitat or manage predators are a core element of game management on state lands. I emphasize that the IM program also includes habitat enhancement in addition to predator control. We have done several habitat enhancement projects across Alaska aimed at improving ungulate numbers. In addition to reliable funding, careful planning is essential to ensuring our state IM programs are both effective and defendable. All state IM programs are guided by an intensive management protocol that ensures decisions are based on the best available science and local input. Intensive management allows us to put food on the table of Alaskans, one of my priorities as commissioner, and are essential to meeting subsistence needs, the department's first priority. Just look at the success we have had in meeting the food needs of Alaskans in the 40-mile caribou herd. This herd, restored through our IM efforts, put over $2.6 million worth of healthy meat in the freezers of Alaskans. I refer to a handout each of you should have. These surcharge funds also ensure that we can implement the state IM law without interference of federal oversight. I remind you that two-thirds of Alaska lands are federal and are off limits to IM activities as they are managed for their natural diversity, not human use, despite a rural subsistence priority. And there is no assurance one can feed one's family under natural diversity objectives. The legislation before you today repeals the sunset on the intensive management surcharge. This proposal does not have any additional cost to the department. Should the surcharge sunset, the department will see a significant decrease in revenue to pay for intensive management activities and our ability to meet our obligations under the state IM law. Revenue from the IM surcharge totaled approximately $1 million in each of the last three calendar years. Most of those funds, especially those that are used to do the research associated with intensive management, can be used to match Pittman-Robertson dollars at a 1-to-3 ratio. With that, I urge your support for this important piece of legislation. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have. And I know one of those questions is muck socks covered. It is not specifically identified in the state IM law, but that doesn't prohibit the Board of Game from doing activities on state on muck socks if they so chose to deal with it to increase food consumption priorities.
Thank you. Senator Steadman has a question.
Just a point of clarification. I think the term used was dedicated funds, and we don't have dedicated funds because of the restriction on the Constitution. We have designated. And under the designated fund subject matter, I'd like to hear from the commissioner on the earlier question from Senator Hoffman, who's dealt with fish and game budget for several decades, about the potential offset, or the concern we have that this potential revenue source just gets offset with other GF. And I'd like to hear about that. And then I have one other question.
Through the chair, Senator Steadman. So this surcharge goes into the Fish and Game Fund. So it doesn't go into as a dedicated fund. It is a dedicated fund, and the Fish and Game Fund is the only dedicated fund in the state. So it is not designated. It is dedicated as it's in the Fish and Game Fund. The second issue is this would not result in a decrease in general fund that the department's asking for. However, if this surcharge isn't extended, we would probably have to dip into existing funds to pay for intensive management because it's a priority.
Thank you. Follow-up, Senator Steadman?
This is just a comment when we're just on the subject matter of hunt, regardless if it's resident or non-resident, but just ensuring that we keep a good balance between us and the animals we hunt and harvest. But in Southeast, they have in the federal forest, they allow deer hunting in January, or the state closes at the 31st of December. In my opinion, it's not much of a hunt, it's just a shoot. They're down on the beach normally, pushed down by the snow. I think it's obnoxious to have that hunt in January when you could get all the deer you want and from August through December. Mm-hmm. So just a point I just thought I'd take the time to make. I know you don't control it. It's not a state-controlled issue. But it's I think, appalling to wait till the animals are pushed down in the winter on the edge of the coast by the snow, and then just run along and shoot them. That's not even hunting. So with that, maybe you can pass that along to your federal buddies, and they should follow the state's closure of December 31st or other dates as Fish and Game decides is appropriate to protect the game animals.
Through the chair, Senator Steadman, we will pass that on. We have many differences of opinion on with our federal partners on how to manage hunting across the state. So we'll pass that one on.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In this two-page document that was provided to us by Fish and Game, it says this surcharge also frees up other funds that can be used to leverage federal Pittman-Robertson funds. Can you just explain how this federal match works? Is it money comes in, $1 million, and then we get another three on top of that, or how exactly is that working?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Wilkowski. So we can use this money to match federal funds at a rate of 3-to-1. And what we do is we use a portion of this $1 million to actually use that to match federal funds at a 3-to-1 ratio. Most of the money we use is to do the research involved with assessing populations of moose and caribou and deer, assessing the predator populations before we even get into conducting intensive management. We also use a portion of these funds without match to to actually go out and conduct the predator control if that's necessary and identified as the preferred tool by the Board of Game. And that frees us then from federal oversight as to how that predator control may be taken, because there's no federal dollars associated with the actual predation control on the landscape. So we don't use all of the money for a 3-to-1 match with federal dollars, but a good chunk of it goes into that assessment tools under our protocols with the Board of Game to do this based on sound science.
Follow-up, Senator Wilikowski.
Different topic, if I could, Mr. Chair. Just if we could just get some clarification on the low-income exemptions. Is there a low-income exemption for the surcharge?
Yeah, the way the surcharge is collected is if, and I was going to try to answer this question for Senator Hoffman, is that everybody in Alaska is a subsistence user, unlike in federal law where it's rural Alaska. So when this was debated, when it was first established, there was discussion whether we should have an exemption for rural Alaska. But it was decided at the time, if I recall back from the legislature, that they decided that since everybody was a subsistence user in the state, everybody would be exempted from having to pay the surcharge potentially. So they decided to instead make it eligible for any low-income person, whether rural or urban, that is qualifies for the $5 license and not have to pay that the surcharge.
Thank you. Senator Wilkowski, are you comfortable with the answer? All right, very good. Question from myself, Commissioner, is you can use some of this money to do surveys, aerial surveys?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
And it has been used for that purpose in the past.
All right, thank you. Any other questions? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The language that Senator Wilikowski refers to is in paragraph 3. So what other funds is the department referring to when it says that this also frees up other funds that can be used to leverage the Pittman-Roberts funds on a 3-to-1 match?
May I see that document?
Take a
third paragraph, the last sentence in the third paragraph. This also frees up other funds that can be used to leverage federal Pittman-Roberts 3-1 match.
I think what that is referring to, Senator, is that if we didn't have the surcharge going forward, we would have to dip into the Fish and Game Fund to conduct ongoing activities in the department, because this is a statute that we have to fulfill. So that would free up those funds to continue the kinds of work that we're currently doing on the landscape to manage wildlife. However, if the surcharge wasn't, if the sunset didn't disappear and we had to then eat that program, we would be using Fish and Game Fund money, and we couldn't use that to match other money. So this is an additional source. I think the wording is a poor choice of wordings. I apologize.
Mr. Chairman, if I may continue, I think the Fish and Game Funds are already specified for a specific purpose, and it would be my preference that if for some reason that this legislation does sunset, that we should also be looking at general funds. State of Alaska stepping behind a program that they say is very, very successful, instead of reducing a program, whatever that might be, in the Fish and Game Fund. So I think that we should possibly, as a committee, think about making an appropriation that is only contingent upon this legislation not passing. So we would have $1 million placed in, or whatever number placed into the budget, that would not be spent if this particular legislation passed, and not utilizing the Fish and Game funds, which would require prioritizing whether or not we want to fund intensive game management versus the current use of those Fish and Game funds. So I find it disturbing that by your comments that you would, by the commissioner, infer that intensive game management would have a higher priority, and you would use Fish and Game funds to fund those activities. We as a state should look at management of our fish and game for abundance, and in that directive, we should be looking at the use of general funds to accomplish that directive. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yep. Senator Stedman.
Good, Mr. Chairman. Maybe we could just have the committee reminded if there's been any of these federal funds returned back to the feds, Pittman-Roberts, because we were unable or didn't want to, as a decision, do the match. Have we left any money on the table in the last several years, Pittman-Roberts?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, there was a history of leaving money on the table for about 3 or 4 years. I think we've got that under control now where we're not leaving money. But again, if we lose this $1 million surcharge money, there's potential we'll be leaving some portion of federal funds that we had planned to conduct intensive management on the table.
Thank you. Follow up, Senator Stedman?
Just to follow up, maybe we can have the commissioner give us in the table format the dollars and the years, just as a reminder of all the, for those folks that aren't on the Fish and Game Subcommittee, the table, so we're tuned up, because that's one of the discussions we have, is maximizing federal receipts or potential receipts. And on a 3-to-1 match, we don't really want to leave that on the table.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, we'd be happy to get that to you. I would note that the surcharge goes into a sub-account of the Fish and Game Fund, so we're able to track that so that it doesn't just simply go into other uses other than intensive management.
Thank you. Any other questions? If not, we're going to go to public testimony.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to open it up for public testimony, and we'd have Mr. John Sturgeon up first with the Safari Club Internationals. Mr. Sturgeon, are you with us?
Good morning. Good morning, Senator Bishop. This is John Sturgeon. I appreciate the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 22. The Safari Club International strongly supports Senate Bill 22. We believe the intensive management surcharge should not be allowed to sunset. Our members believe it has been a huge contributor in assisting Alaska Fish and Game to properly manage Alaska's wildlife resources. And specifically, it's increased game numbers in those areas that the populations have dropped, and the studies Fish and Game has completed show that the numbers have gone up through their intensive management program. So it's something we support. As goes without saying that many, many people in Alaska, especially rural Alaska, are dependent on this wildlife for a food source, and it's something that we totally support. And it's been said before that this is a program that is funded by the users themselves, and it's something that we think that's with our current fiscal situation that that people that use the resources should pay for those resources through licenses or whatever. So in closing, I appreciate the opportunities to talk on supporting this bill. And once again, we adamantly support Senate Bill 22. And thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you for your comments, Mr. Sturgeon. Next, we have in the queue, Al Barrett from Fairbanks. Al, put yourself on the record in 2 minutes, please.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And committee members, my name is Al Barrett. I reside in Fairbanks, and I'm a subsistence hunter and trapper, and for full disclosure, I'm also a member of the Board of Game, but I'm not representing them. I support this bill. I've seen great increases in some of our caribou and moose populations because of it. The only thing I would ask is maybe we amend this bill, since this bill is asking to seek a permanent fee structure for intensive management, $10 for residents, $30 for non-residents, that we just add this to the fee of a hunting license permanently. So instead of having a separate line on, accountability by the department or when you're buying your hunting license, you just pay the one fee. You don't have to have it separate. I feel this is much more efficient. It doesn't take away from the program, and we'll be able to move forward with another line out of the statute. So I think it's better just to have a license fee increase, and it's permanent, and it'll be the success of this program. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for your comments. We have no one else on the line for public testimony. So public testimony is closed. Any questions for members before we set this bill aside? Seeing none, we're going to set this bill aside. We're going to take just a brief of these. All right, we'd like to call the Finance Committee meeting back to order. We're going to continue on with SB 19. Senator Stevens is still seconded under other business in the building on for the state, and his trusty aide, Mr. Lampkin, can present the bill. We'd like to have Senator Stevens here, but we understand where he's at and what he's doing. So to keep moving along, Senator Stedman is back with us now. We've got a full deck, and we're ready to roll. So this is the first hearing of Senate Bill 19. Again, our intention, we're going to hear and hold this bill. And Mr. Lampkin, if you would put yourself on the record, give us a bill introduction and a highlighted section, it would be appreciated.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Tim Lampkin, staff to Senator Stevens. We want to thank you for hearing this bill. Unfortunately, as you indicated, Senator Stevens is unable to join us at this time. This is the second time we've had the honor of assisting the Sunset Extension for the Special Education Service Agency, and you're going to be hearing that referred to as CESA hereafter. The last time was in 2013. As you may know or recall, that CESA provides a pretty valuable public service to families and students around the state, offering expert assistance for children with rare and complex disabilities. As you'll be hearing from others here shortly, they're based in Anchorage, but they extend their services statewide. And they've responded very positively to their last audit that occurred in 2012 and 13. I'm going to leave most of the talking for those folks. I just thought I'd touch upon the fact that in the last committee, as regards changes to the bill, we changed the effective date, or the extension rather, to from 2028 to 29. That was a simple error, drafting error, that would reflect the maximum allowable extension of 8 years per the statute. So then we've got the executive director handy. We have a short presentation he's going to give. I'll facilitate the slide flips. We also have the auditor from Legislative Budget and Audit and representative from Deeds to discuss the fiscal note. With right. that, I might roll right into the sectional. It's pretty quick.
Yeah, it's pretty quick.
Okay.
Briefly.
So Section 1 simply extends the sunset date to June 30th, 2029. Section 2 provides for a retroactive effective date in the event the bill doesn't pass this year. And then Section 3 would be an immediate effective date upon its passage.
Thank you. Okay. We do have Ms. Heidi Teschner from Deed. Finance and Support Services is online and available for questions. And now we'll go into invited testimony. And Mr. Patrick Pillay, Executive Director for the Special Education Service Agency, is with us via audio conference. Mr. Pillay, please take our welcome from the Senate Finance Committee, put yourself on the record, and we will begin with your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you. Good morning. My name is Patrick Pillay. I have been the executive director of CESA for the past 9 years. I'm sorry, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Thank you. I joined the agency in 1994 as a deaf education specialist, making this my 27th year of CESA service. Thank you for the opportunity to address the Senate, and please stop me at any time with any questions that you might have. I have 17 slides, but I'll go through them pretty quickly. Slide 2, please. This is the homepage of CESA's website. It provides online access to program services and resources, a lending library, online professional development, e-modules, and an easy process for school districts to submit online referrals for CESA service. The yellow text, the agency's mission statement, reflects the agency's focus on addressing the unique special education needs of students, parents, and teachers across Alaska's 54 school districts via year-round on-site and distance-delivered consultation and training. Next slide, please. CESA's legacy of special education support evolved from the intent of Public Law 94-142, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act of 1975, reauthorized in 2004 and amended in 2015 as the Every Student Succeed Act. The law mandates a free and appropriate public education to students with disabilities. CESA activity assists parents and school district staff make tangible, through specialized educational interventions, the services mandated by special education law. Next slide, please. The statute establishing CESA specifically addresses technical assistance and service to students with low-incidence disabilities. Low-incidence disabilities is defined in the literature as occurring in less than 1% of the total population. The rarity of the disability manifests in the reality of possible infrequent need by a district, and as a consequence, special education services therefore not normally available. An example is the situation of one child with deafness in a rural school district with no access to a sign language interpreter and a special education teacher with any prior experience working with a deaf child. CESA affords such sites access to a specialist with an endorsement in deaf education. In addition to consultation, support and training, other supplementary services are available. Example, assistance with application of mini grants, programming and setting up assistive technology, cross-district trainings, etc. Next slide, please. Although Alaska Statute 1430-630B states that CESA shall focus on provision of low-incidence disability services, it does, under eligibility of services in AS 1430-350, indicate that CESA may provide services to disability categories other than low-incidence disabilities. It is through this qualification that CESA provides services to students with autism. School district requests for autism services currently comprise a CESA autism caseload exceeding 100 students. Requests for in-servicing staff on the topic of autism continues to increase each year. Many requests are for school-wide or district-wide trainings when numbers of students with autism are high. Larger districts have higher numbers. Anchorage has 700, Fairbanks 169, Kenai 110, Juneau 78, and Kodiak 38. Most rural schools have numbers that range between 0 and 23. Next slide, please.
Mr. Pillay, could you provide to our group the numbers in rural Alaska by region, please? You described Fairbanks and Anchorage, but you could just send a documentation to our office.
Yes, I will do so. I have a document that outlines everything. I will forward that.
Thank you. Please continue, sir.
Slide 6. CSIS logic model captures the design and process to deliver specialized services to parents, students, and school districts. The intent is to address the gap via solutions that promote not only availability of CSIS services, but increases through on-site and distance support the local capacity of the individual site and school district. This approach is critical to meeting the needs of rural schools and of creating broad participant training to address staff turnover. Through trainings provided to school districts via common platforms, collaboration and networking amongst teachers and paraprofessionals is increased. This leads to sharing of resources, reduces isolation, and ultimately promotes retention of teachers, especially in rural remote areas of the state. Slide 7, please. As part of operational process, CSIS created benchmarks to guide specialist delivery of high standard of service. The benchmarks provide a threshold of expectation and guide specialist evaluation for continuous improvement. A flow of service delivery includes contact with district staff to establish relationships, identify site need, to plan technical assistance, complete activities of file maintenance and compliance review, prioritize site need as targeted, which means some local capacity but site needs service, intensive, where there's no local capacity and there's the greatest need for service, or general, where there's capacity present but needs minimal guidance on how to proceed. Create a technical assistance objective based on review and site communication. Provide technical assistance and training. Next slide, please. Slide 8 demystifies technical assistance. The continuum of services includes observations, assessments, educational interventions, modeling of strategies, in-service trainings, assistive technology, and many more pertinent activities based on requests from the child's educational team members. It also includes other services such as assisting families when they visit ANMC for medical services, organizing and facilitating orientation and mobility training in the larger city of Anchorage for orientation and mobility exposure to navigate pavements, streetlights, and traffic. Specialists also work with vendors to troubleshoot assistive technology when teachers call with complaints of device non-functionality. Next slide, please. Using feedback from our annual public audit and sunset legislative audits, CSIS has designated a management system to include metrics for program and specialist evaluation. Post-service satisfaction surveys are both emailed to service recipients and are available on each specialist iPad to make service feedback easier to collect. Feedback is shared and discussed with individual specialists, and collective information is shared with all specialists for continuous improvement of individual and agency-wide performance. Next slide, please. Slide 10. In addition to specialist evaluation, the CSIS management system is designed to collect data on various aspects of agency activity. An activity is designed as any service contact that is 15 minutes or more. Service contact less than 15 minutes is captured in communication logs. Metrics focus on mission-centric activities such as site travel, creation of educational materials, training and in-services, and writing of student service reports. Data is analyzed to understand variables impacting service and variables impacting the CESA budget. Slide 11, please. This slide is a visual example of the customized management system CESA has designed to ensure data-driven decision-making. Individual reports provide data on specialist activity, allowing for measurement of productivity, the number of reports completed within agency time frame of 10 working days from site visit, schools and sites requesting service, active and historical student caseloads by district, location, and school, etc. Next slide, please. Both legislative audits and the program component of annual public audits run tests of compliance with regard to process, procedure, and special education laws and regulations. This section of the database was created in response for specific data and with feedback from auditors. Following a recommendation of the CESA board to go green, CESA management worked to eliminate paper files. All of CESA's student record keeping is now electronic. The compliance element of the CESA database drives quarterly compliance reviews. This section of the database earns praise from auditors for its elegant simplicity of compliance review. Next slide, please. Slide 13 captures in red the number of students attending Alaska schools in any given year between 2011 and 2020. The solid blue line captures the steadily increasing numbers of students on CESA's low incidence caseload. Increasing numbers of students with LID means greater need for CESA services. High turnover of staff in many districts often drives the need for repeated trainings for new staff, especially first-year teachers who may be encountering any given disability for the very first time. Next slide, please.
Senator, Mr. Pillay, Senator Studman has a question.
Well, looking ahead in this legislative report, help me with this a little bit, if you could. There's apparently three students in Juneau. This is on page 8, not slide 8. It's page 8 of the Division of Legislative Audits report. But they're showing three kids in Juneau. 38 in Sitkin, Ketchikan combined. Sitkin, Ketchikan combined have about two-thirds of the population of Juneau. So it's 38-3.
I'm sorry, it's really hard to hear.
Senator Stubby, can you restate your question? Can you hear us, Mr. Pillay?
It's very choppy. It's breaking up. I could try... I'm going to remove my external microphone to see if the computer works better. Okay, could you please try again?
Okay, let me restate this. This is referring to the legislative audit, page 8, and it's referencing the issue of the slide 14 as far as when we're talking about the amount of kids and dollars. But it's showing here that Juneau has three kids, young Alaskans. Ketchikan and Juneau combined have 38. Well, Juneau or Sitkin, Ketchikan are two-thirds of the population of Juneau combined, and there's 38 kids in Sitkin, Ketchikan combined and three in Juneau. So the numbers don't seem right. Juneau has a significant school system, and I don't think the demographics they're a little different, but I'd be surprised if they're a whole lot different in the aggregate. And then I look at Wrangell, which is a fraction of the size of Juneau, Wrangell being somewhere in the neighborhood of a couple thousand people, Juneau at 35,000, they each have three kids. So one of the concerns we have at the table dealing with education funding is that the kids are properly classified so we could be assured that the school districts are not taking advantage of formula anomalies embedded in the district formula. So, Mr. Chairman, if I could, at some point, he can address this or get back to the committee, but it just appears on the surface that there's something definitely odd with the amount of kids in this program relative to the size of the communities relative to the bigger communities like Juneau.
Thank you, Senator Stebbins. Mr. Pillay, I don't know if you can answer that right now, and if you can't, that's fine, because you're probably not looking at the ledge audit on page 8 in front of you, which we have, that shows the state of Alaska map, and Senator Stebbins referencing those school districts and students served. So if you want to think about that and get us back a capture of his question, my staff can work with your office to fully capture his question to you, and you can get a response back to the committee. Is that fine?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I was not able to hear much of the discussion, but I would be more than happy to answer the question.
Okay. I will have my office get in contact with you, and we will get you the question, and you can give us a written response. Thank you.
Good. It's much clearer now. So, but yeah, I would be more than happy to send a written response to that question.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Lampkin.
For the record, Tim Lampkin. I can take a stab at that question if he couldn't quite understand it. It's my understanding that districts, there's a threshold at which when the district hits 10 students, then that's when, and if their population is big enough in that district, then they're expected to apply their own resources to help those students. It really depends on quite a wide variety and complex variety of the manner of the disabilities that we're talking about. But that's part of why we're seeing these different numbers, is that some districts have more resources available to them to apply to that body of students as opposed to some other districts. I hope that helps, at least for now.
Thank you. Senator Stebbins?
That helps a little bit, but I'd still like to have a more detailed answer and reference to the formula. I'm just curious on a little more detail, and I recognize that there's different sources available, different size school districts, but.
And we do have Heidi Teschner available too. Heidi, are you there?
Good morning, yes, this is Heidi Reichel, Heidi Teschner, Director of Finance and Support Services with the Department of Education Early Development.
You heard Co-Chair Stedman's question. I hope you've been following along. Could you shed any more light on this topic as he's to his question, please?
Through the chair, as Mr. Lampkin said, there's a lot of the actual number of students that participate in this program it's going to vary across districts, and it's going to vary across the state based on the needs of those districts. The needs of the students. The funding itself is based on the adjusted average daily membership multiplied by $18.65 that's set out in statute. So that is the funding mechanism that CESA gets. But the actual number and location of the students that participate is not tied to their funding. And I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, Senator Stedman.
Well, we'll work on it between our offices, and we'll get the question answered. But thank you, Ms. Teschner. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Ms. Teschner. Can you address the $18.65 per student, and how long has that rate been in effect?
Senator Hoffman, oh, I'm sorry.
Ms. Teschner, did you hear Senator Hoffman's question?
Yes, I did. I don't have the exact time frame at the tip of my fingers. I don't know if Mr. Lampkin or Mr. Pillay do.
So we got a lifeline, Mr. Lampkin?
Mr. Chairman, Tim Lampkin, Staff Senator Stevens. The current formulaic structure was set at its last audit cycle in 2013. It's been on the books since then, and it's prior to that, it had been about 15 or so years. Their funding mechanism has not changed much. And that's certainly something worth talking about.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Lampkin.
Also, while we're paused here, there was a question, I think, by you, Mr. Chairman, as regards a breakdown by districts of the number of students served, and you're going to find that on the audit on page 27, 28, Appendix B.
Thank you. Please continue, Mr. Pillay. Slide 14.
Oh. I'm sorry, I've got my papers up. So slide 14. Slide 14 is the history of CESA fund balance from 2013 and projected to 2023. The cycle captures the low funds, usually seen at the end of a sunset cycle, 2013, higher funds at the middle of the cycle, and the trending to lower fund balance at the end of the cycle as a result of increasing costs. The typical scenario is slightly different in 2021. We would have used $515,000 of fund balance, but instead we will be adding $120,000 to fund balance, and this is due specifically to two premium holidays of health insurance, two unfilled specialist vacancies, unspent travel funds in COVID times, $175,000 in discretionary funding received from the Department of Education Early Development to assist CESA to hire two new specialists in 2019 and to boost fund balance beyond reauthorization without knowing when a funding increase may next be available. CESA's last funding increase was in 2014, 15 years post the previous funding increase. And at the time of this, at the end of this fiscal year, 2021, due to the impact of COVID-19 on travel, we anticipate adding 120 to fund balance. At the end of fiscal year 22, factoring for cost increases, we anticipate using $578,000 from fund balance. This is as a result of the impact of a CPI index increase of 6.3% over the last 7 years and compounding salary and health benefit increases to stay competitive with hiring. And since I have a moment, if I may, I can address the other question that was asked earlier on. The manner in which students receive services is a referral process, so they have to qualify as intensive students. That referral is then received by CESA, and depending on the number of requests that we get from individual school districts, we provide that service. Next slide, please.
Thank you. Senator Wilson has a question on slide 14, Mr. Pillay.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Pillay, did CESA get any CARES Act funding or expected to have any CARES Act funding in FY22 to help offset some of the decrease in school population?
No, we do not qualify for the CARES Act funding.
Thank you. No further questions. Slide 15, please.
The recently completed legislative audit concurs that CESA meets the needs of students with low-incidence disabilities, provides professional development opportunities to teachers and paraprofessionals, provides special education resources to parents and school district staff, and concludes with a recommendation for 8-year legislative reauthorization. Next slide, please. Slide 16. CESA is requesting reauthorization to continue providing the key services identified by the state of Alaska as being important to the full academic and social development of a child with a disability. This includes all the activities of technical assistance reviewed earlier in the presentation. Next slide, please. CESA's customized database allows us to run reports of agency productivity. The slide captures activities of technical assistance, number of schools and districts served, number of trainings, customized in general, conducted on-site and via distance delivery, an analysis of funds saved with CESA's investment in technologies of distance delivery. Savings are more than are more than indicated on slide 17, since savings are also realized with site consultation provided via distance delivery and not only with trainings. And that concludes my presentation, unless you have any questions for me.
Any questions for Mr. Pillay? Seeing none, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you. I have a question for the department.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Does the department or the administration support this legislation?
Ms. Teschner, did you hear the question?
Hello. I did. Yes, for the record, this is Heidi Teschner. And yes, I did hear Senator Hoffman's question. The department does support continuing CISA, then that we agree that it meets the valid public need. And there is a letter on page 35 of the legislative audit report that has the department's letter of support.
Thank you.
A follow-up question.
Please.
And what is the department's position on the amount of funding that has not been increased since FY13?
Through the chair, the department doesn't have a position on the amount. We are super supportive of the CISA's work overall, so having funding match their support would be something that we would definitely entertain working with the committee and the sponsor in addressing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yep. Mr. Lampkin, you want to come make a comment?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I believe you'll find some interesting commentary from the auditor when we come to that on that very question.
Thank you. With that being said, thank you, Mr. Lampkin, and now we'll have Ms. Curtis from Ledge Audit come up, please, and put herself on the record and begin your testimony. Ms. Curtis, welcome to Senate Finance.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Chris Curtis. I'm your state legislative auditor. We did conduct a sunset audit. It should be in your packets. It's dated April 2020. I'd like to start off with page 5, which is the background information section. Again, CISA was created to help Alaskan school districts provide special education to individuals with a low-incidence disability. Again, low-incidence disability occurs in less than 1% of the national school-aged population, and the disabilities are more severe in nature and require specialized education intervention. CISA was established as a nonprofit corporation. Its governing board is the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education, which is housed within the Department of Health and Social Services. But its primary service is low-incidence outreach program is funded and budgeted by the Department of Education and Early Development. Now, this funding is independent of the intensive needs funding that a district may otherwise receive, and I believe this is to Senator Stedman's concern about the funding. So this is in addition to the intensive needs funding that a district may otherwise receive. CISA's funding provides additional financial support to help ensure students affected by a low-incidence disability are receiving free and appropriate public education as required by state and federal law. CISA services are available to districts whose low-incidence special education needs occur infrequently, making it difficult for the district to serve the low number of students in need of a particular service. CISA recruits, trains, and retains education specialists to provide technical assistance and training to students, parents, and district staff without regard to location in the state. The number and locations of students, again, is on that page 8 of the audit. You will see the map. As of February 2020, there were 335 students served across 48 school districts. And again, appendices C, starting on page 27, breaks those students out by their low-incidence disability category. Report conclusions begin on page 11. Now, overall, the audit concludes that CISA served the public's interest by assisting school districts in providing students affected by low-incidence disabilities an education to meet the children's unique needs, and by providing opportunities to enhance school district teachers' and paraprofessionals' capabilities, and by providing resources. We recommend the legislature extend this agency 8 years, which is the maximum allowed for in statute. We did send out a survey to the special education directors of all 51 school districts. We had a response rate of 59%. The questions and responses are in the appendix. In general, the special education directors viewed CESA's services, staff availability, and expertise favorably. On page 13 of the audit, we talk about their funding formula. So as Heidi talked about, its low incidence outreach program is funded by taking $18.65 and multiplying it by the Alaska's state's student average daily membership. Now that rate was set in 2013. It hasn't been changed since that point. However, the caseload, the LID caseload for CESA has increased 63% during that time frame. Now, we found that CESA's education specialists were serving certain student categories had high caseloads. And we also found that as of February 2020, the agency had 3 education specialist vacancies. And in this audit, we talk about the struggle that the agency has had to recruit, that their wages were below Anchorage or other school districts. They had health benefits that were below other school districts, so the agency itself has had a hard time recruiting those specialists. We do have one recommendation. It's on page 18. We tested 42 student files, and in doing so, we found 5 students' disabilities, as identified in the school district referral forms, had been reclassified by a CESA specialist, and there was just a lack of documentation in the file to explain why a disability had been reclassified. We also found for 4 of 5 of those 5 cases that we didn't see any documentation that the revised disability had been communicated to school district personnel. So we recommended CESA's executive director implement written procedures to ensure reclassification of a student's referred disability is adequately supported and communicated to school district staff. As far as response to the audit, that begins on page 35. Generally, the Commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services, Commissioner of the Department of Education and Early Development, as well as the CESA's board chair, agree with the report conclusions and the recommendation.
Thank you. Questions of Ms. Curtis? Senator Wilson?
Yes, thank you, Ms. Curtis, for providing this audit to us today. Overview. CESA's, the recommendation, was it to allow more students to receive services, or was it to make them ineligible for services in those cases?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, the recommendation is simply to improve documentation. So they have, when CESA services are requested, school district has to provide certain documentation to the agency to justify their eligibility, and that identifies a student's disability. So CESA education specialists then verify that disability, and in doing so, they may reclassify. Maybe there's a slightly different disability that they reclassify that in the documentation. And so our finding was that reclassification wasn't being communicated, or at least it wasn't documented in the file that they were communicating that revised disability to the school district. Now, the school district, CESA helps school district personnel provide services to the students. They're a supportive agency, and they work with the parents, the staff, and provide training, that type of thing. So it's important that everyone's clear on what the disability is. So it's just a simple administrative recommendation that we believe should be easily fixed.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just looking at Appendix B on page 27, it just lists for Anchorage just 2 deafblind students. And I'm just curious, is Anchorage exempt from this program, or what's the relationship there?
Right, through the chair, Senator Wilikowski. So you shouldn't expect to see many CESA students at large districts. And that is because this is supplemental. It helps fill the holes. So if an agency, so on page 6, second paragraph down, we describe that it's only available to districts that don't have the resources to provide the services. So once a district gets, one of our recommendations the last go around was that you really need to have some type of policy. So when the threshold reaches a certain number of students, the district gets funding. So once they have a certain number of students, they should be taking over those services and providing them themselves, as opposed to relying on CESA to do that. So they actually did establish a threshold. It's 10 students per LID category, low incidence category. So when a district reaches that 10 person threshold, CESA will engage the district in discussions about transferring those services to the district. They will assist them through the recruitment phase to hire their own specialists or teachers to help the students. So Anchorage has a fairly rigorous, you wouldn't expect to see. Juneau has a staff. Now, they still might not have staff to address a specific, unique disability, and they can rely on CESA to do that. So I would expect Juneau to have lower number of students than, say, Sitka or Wrangell or Petersburg.
Thank you. Any other questions for Ms. Curtis? As always, well done, and thank you. And we'll go to public testimony now. And let's see. I believe we have one in Juneau, is that right? Katie Votes, are you there?
Yes, sir. Can you hear me?
Yes. Put yourself on the record and please give us your testimony.
Yes, sir. Good morning. Thank you for allowing me to testify. For the record, my name is Katie Votes, and I'm from Juneau, Alaska. And I'm speaking on behalf of myself. I'm sorry. When I was a young student, I was diagnosed with profoundly deaf. The hearing pictures that I lost were high pictures, which include fire alarm, cooking alarm. I would joke around saying that I could hear all the big and obnoxious birds, but the little tiny, elegant birds, I couldn't hear. I couldn't enunciate any of my S, SH, TH, ED on my wording from when I was in kindergarten to, I don't know, like ninth grade. So my parents put me through the special education program to try to help me go through numerous amount of speech therapy, and with that I was able to gain some motor skills to be able to attempt to speak properly. But although being the youngest of four kids, even in the household, it was my parents and my teachers who were the only one who could understand what I was trying to say. Not even my three brothers, which were really frustrating growing up, because my parents had to interpret everything for the family. So I put in countless hours. I even wanted to give up. I'm wanting to complain about the special education program because it was elementary, it was middle school, it was partial high school as well, and it was just hours after hours of speech therapy. But when I was in my freshman year of high school, I realized that I was able to be a part of the student government for Kodiak High School, and we invited Special Olympics as part of our statewide statewide student government association, and there it was really interesting to be able to write up a speech and to present it to about 360 students across the state, which was my very first time in any public speaking. I am completely for this bill. I ask that you guys fund this bill and to help all students who are in the special education program, no matter where they are located, because they do a tremendous amount of work and they help our students more than anyone could properly say the appreciation. If it wasn't for the special education program and the countless hours of speech therapy, I would not be able to testify today, nor any of the previous or future times of testifying. I do have a bit of an insecurity when it comes to public testimonies, and that's only because I know that I speak differently from everyone else. So please help our students succeed. Please help our students have the security in themselves. And I ask for you to fund this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Katie. We really appreciate it. And I don't see any other testimony online. I'll look over here. We're good to go. Everybody's, any closing comments from committee members? Seeing none, we are going to set this bill aside. And tomorrow, that concludes today's meeting. We're closing public testimony. And we're going to conclude today's meeting. Our next meeting is tomorrow, Wednesday, March 3rd, 9 a.m., Village Safe Water Funding History, Projection and Needs for FY22, and bills previously heard. Seeing no other business, we are adjourned at 10:25.